Welcome back, everybody, to the Escape Collective Tour Daily Podcast. I sound terrible in my ear here.
You sound worse since you got the mic out.
My voice was fading last night's podcast. You probably heard it at the end. And now it's struggling, hanging on for dear life, or hopeful it comes
back
tomorrow.
We can do some big pulls this podcast and help you save your voice.
Dane literally just texted, "Hey, if you all haven't recorded yet, can you please give a head over to escapecollective.com/join in the first few minutes of the show to mix up a little bit so that the listeners get a break from hearing disembodied voices of me and Abby asking them to do so."
That's like when professional footballers get sent potential social media quotes from their like PR people where it says, "Can you say something like really great game from the boys tonight, looking forward on to next week?" I enjoyed it.
Fans were amazing. We go again next week.
Yeah. I can't believe someone gets paid to do that job. That's an easy job.
Should we mention that people should go do that?
I just want to thank the team.
I think Kay did. You should definitely head over to escapecollective.com/join because we're currently doing the $1 sale, which won't last forever.
Yep.
And if you do it now, you get the last few days of the tour where we've got some good things lined up. And we've got the Tour de France Femme avec Zwift coming up.
Yeah.
And while these podcasts are free, they're not free to make.
Abby just got to Clermont-Ferrand.
Sometimes it may seem like that, but it's not free.
Abby just got to Clermont-Ferrand, our favorite place in France.
Did you see? I think she posted on Instagram. She has labeled the clothes she's going to wear on each day, which is a very different approach to how I attend races or just any sort of trip. She's got little sticky notes on them.
I've been wearing the same pair of shorts for like 5 days.
I haven't noticed. I did washing this morning.
I've changed
and a lot
the underwear underneath them. But yeah.
Well, that's fine then.
Yeah. It's been hot, so I put shorts on.
There's no point, yeah.
Yeah.
Should talk about the bike race?
Yeah.
Kate?
So, today, Matej Mohoric won in a photo finish against Kasper Asgreen, who was going for the twofer. And it was an extremely active day of racing, you could say. It started at kilometer zero and really didn't stop until literally the very end. It was one of the most gangbusters days of bike racing I think I have seen in a long time. Because, I mean, it's obvious, right? Because you have all of these teams who haven't won anything or want to win something else. And this is kind of their last day to do it if they don't have climbers or think they can't beat Philipsen in a sprint in Paris. So you can imagine that there was lots of breakaway Machiavellian tactics going on. Philipsen and Groenewegen themselves ended up getting into an iteration of this breakaway. But eventually, after like 7,000 different changes in who was at the front and who with and why, that are just too numerous to recount here. And in fact, when I was writing my daily recap, I was like, if I keep documenting everything that happens, this is going to be the world's most boring novel. That there was a three-up between Ben O'Connor, Mohoric, and Kasper Asgreen. And this went all the way to the end where they sprinted, and Mohoric won by millimeters.
Bike throw.
And when he won, he burst into tears.
Yeah. I was standing right there. I posted the video. He was sort of collapsed to the ground, was exhausted, and then the adrenaline of hearing that he'd won got him to his feet. And then, yeah, he was crying. Very emotional. A bit of an early throw, but should we throw to Jack Haig, who I caught up with, to explain a bit more about his day in the breakaway? Because Bahrain Victorious had, obviously, Mohoric, Jack Haig, and Fred Wright in the breakaway, who sort of collaborated to help that final move stick.
Let's hear from him.
Just today, the break looked like it was just fucking all guns blazing all day. What did it actually feel like in the legs in the breakaway?
Mate, to be honest, I didn't want to be in the breakaway. I followed one attack because I punched it at the beginning. And then I followed one attack and I was in the breakaway with eight super strong guys. And I was like, what am I doing here? I want to have an easy day for tomorrow. And then I was super happy when Matej and Fred came across in that bigger group. But we obviously had some really strong sprinters there. So we knew we needed to get away in a small group. And when Matej got away there, me and Fred, we just tried our best to disrupt the chase behind. And yeah, I'm super happy for him, to be honest. He's been working super hard trying to find the breakaway all Tour de France, and it's worked out at the very end.
Okay, thank you, mate.
Yeah, at this stage of the tour, not every rider wants to be in the breakaway anymore. Sometimes you just end up in the breakaway because you have the legs rather than... Sometimes your legs beat your head, maybe.
Or you've been assigned to cover some moves, and the moves go, and you follow, and then you're like, ah, I was kind of hoping this one wouldn't go. Oops.
Get swept along. But yeah, great tour for Bahrain Victorious now with 3 stage wins. Second most to Alpecin de Koenig, I believe.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, the Richard on the Escape Collective members Discord did some light digging and found out, because Askren finished first and then second from a breakaway that wasn't like a really mountainous stage. And the last rider we think to do that was Peter Sagan, who did it second and first when it was the Froome Crosswinds in 2016. It's a good bit of trivia.
It's a great stat.
Good stat. Kate, do we... Surely that wasn't all you had to say on this Mahorič win.
No, his interview was really remarkable. I'm sure everyone has seen it already. Mahorič is really well known for doing really long and descriptive interviews. And in the last year or so, he won Milan-San Remo in 2022, but then kind of faded away. He had Epstein-Barr last year at the Tour, and he just had a number of really kind of terrible setbacks that sort of culminated, I think, with the death of Gino Mader, who he was really notably a mentor to. And I mean, I can read some quotes off about that later if you want. But anyways, he hasn't been himself for some time, actually, for us. Either in the Slovenian press or in the English-speaking press. He's just kind of been withdrawn and a little bit morose, I would say, which is not like him because he's a very energetic and intelligent guy.
Yeah, good speaker, yeah.
But today, he really returned to that old self, and he gave one of the most phenomenal exit interviews I've ever heard in cycling. The first thing he said is he was talking about how cycling is such a cruel sport, and it's cruel because... It's cruel. He said it was cruel because everyone, the riders, the staff, and he mentioned all of the staff, the mechanics, the soigneurs, the nutritionists, everyone, they spend like these 12-hour days, on the road, away from their families, like sacrificing everything for a win, and it doesn't always come. A win in the Tour de France changed his life in a way that I think he's only now, and just sort of like in his reflective period, because he's been in the peloton for about 10 years now, which is hard to think because he's like, what, only 27? That it changed his life in ways that he's still reckoning with. It made his life bigger, but it also, I think, made it harder when he was struggling because the expectations were so high. And he's sitting here reconciling with all this, like, in the exit interview, just stream of consciousness. If you haven't seen it, really go watch it. It's one of the most moving speeches I've ever heard.
He kind of built on that idea as well, on the cruelty and the beauty of cycling. And he said something that really stuck with me about breakaways and kind of made me think differently about them, because it is so hard to get into a breakaway and stay in one, as we saw today, which was like maybe one of the hardest breakaways, you know, to make stick of the season.
I mean, there's a huge one that went and stayed away for like 40 or 50K, and then after that came back, the one
right.
with Niels Pollitt in it.
Full of quality riders. I mean, Alaphilippe was in that one, and I mean, there were Pedersen as well. But what he said is, you know, when you work that hard with a couple of people for so long...
You have to betray them in the end.
Exactly. I thought that was an oddly poetic and quite lucid thing to say after, you know, nearly 200K of racing.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's kind of an open secret that, like, when you're a breakaway guy like that, you're doing a lot of engineering, and he is kind of like an engineer. He was talking in the press conference about how he pictures the race as if he's a sports director or viewing it from the helicopter in order to make, like, the most...
coherent decisions.
Yeah, like, best possible strategic decisions. But at the end of the day, like, the relationship is really parasitic. If you're a guy like Mahorič, who is known to win from a breakaway, and you're in a breakaway with a bunch of other guys, like, why should they work for you? And his job is to convince everyone that, like, the risk of him being there are worth the rewards of, like, a potential win that comes from working together. That's a really hard and political needle to thread.
Yeah, for sure. You saw that even in the finale, where you're, like, thinking, is Askren going to get 2 in a row, or is Ben O'Connor going to surprise everyone with the sprint of his life to beat them? Probably not. But then you saw Mahorič always managed to find that, like, third position. Like, he'd put a turn and then, like, swing on. Like, Ben O'Connor was trying the same thing, but it wouldn't work. And throughout it all, and then Askren launched his sprint. And he's, like, beating Van der Poel in, like, Tour of Flanders sprint. So he's not a slouch. And then literally the last second, Mihoric comes around, and it's the bike throw, really, you were saying, Kaylee.
Yeah, it all came down to the bike throw. I mean, you could see it in the finish line camera, where the way that those cameras work, it's not like a regular photo. And basically, like, the shortness of Askren's bike points to the fact that he was probably actually moving faster, but, yeah, didn't time it quite right. I think he actually went a bit, I think he threw a bit early. Because, but, you know, basically the physics of a bike throw, right, is that your body weighs a lot more than the bike does, and so you shove the bike in front of you, and it doesn't, like, slow your body down. It just gets your bike out in front of you. And so if you time it wrong, you can't stay behind the bike that long, right? You'll literally fall off the back of it at some point. So he timed it wrong. And, Mohoric timed it absolutely perfectly. I think he was also helped by Ben O'Connor's kind of early run out. O'Connor went at over 300 meters to go, which frankly was, he's a climber. It was his only shot. He had to.
Yeah, and the other two look at each other and then wait too long.
He had to try. But because he did try there, he ended up kind of pulling a, like, he forced Askren to also go a little bit early, which I think is for the reason why Mihoric ended up winning the sprint.
It turned into a Mihoric sprint train.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just twice as big as Askren's one before with Victor Campenaerts. How we saw the satisfaction of a breakaway staying away, like, as one of those things that you enjoy about cycling. I want to add to that list when riders don't know they've won after the finish line, and you have that little lull before the delayed victory. Like, it's the opposite of the frustration of VAR in football, where it's actually more satisfying when you have the unknowing.
Well, because you haven't got a previous sort of celebration that could be wrong.
Yeah.
No one celebrated. They just sort of sat there tense, you know, after an enormous
well, exhausted,
stage.
Waiting
for Seb Piquet to say something over the radio.
A lot of the riders were saying that today was basically like a one-day classic.
It looked
and,
like it.
And for that to come, I didn't see much of the race. I was in the car with some of our photographer friends for the day, which you can talk about in a bit. That was telling when I arrived at the finish line, had like 10K to go, and you saw the riders come across the line and they were cooked. And for this for this one day classic to happen 19 racing days into the tour is savage.
There's an expression in Slovenian that I think describes a lot of breakaway sentiments. And the expression goes, dobrota je sirota, which means goodwill or happiness is an orphan. It's kind of their version of no good deed goes unpunished.
Okay.
But a little bit more, not cynical, but I would say pointed, which is that, you do all this work for other people, and in the end, only one of them can win. And they all go kind of into it knowing. And Mohoric said something really interesting in the press conference, which is, he said, I'm not on the bike, I'm not emotional. I try to suppress all of that stuff. And then it's only after that the emotion flows. Mm-hmm. But he said that he notices that other riders are emotional, that he reads them, and he looks for that emotion, that one sliver of a mistake.
Yeah, he's always very composed. Like, you never see much like facial movement or anything when he's on the bike,
like,
no. Yeah.
He looks for that one sliver of a mistake that he can kind of work his way into. It's just a really interesting kind of dichotomy at work there between, like, this surgical sort of calculative nature and this just like huge outpouring, this huge litany of cycling that comes out of it. It's like, was he thinking about that the whole time he was riding? Like, because it was like a speech out of a novel.
He's a good speaker.
Yeah,
he's a good speaker.
In what, his second or third language?
It is his third.
Yeah.
He speaks Italian.
Anything else specifically about the bike race? Is that items I think we should cover from today's, well, what happened like in the world today in cycling today?
Niels Pollitt's chain broke.
Oh, you want to talk about that?
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Just really briefly, because it was kind of funny. It was tragic, but it was also kind of funny because Niels Pollitt is like 6.5 feet tall.
Yeah, he's huge.
He's enormous. And there was no team car behind him because the gap between the brake and the peloton at that point was too small. He'd made his way into this breakaway, which is great because yesterday he was charged with chasing down the breakaway, and he did a good job of that, although in the end they failed. So today he's in the break, and broke a chain, which was a bummer. Needed to get a new bike, but his team car was behind the peloton, so that would have negated his entire massive effort to get into the breakaway to begin with. What was behind him was the Shimano Neutral Service. The first bike he
Harbinger
got
of Doom in a very specific
this
blue.
Is like Goldilocks and the Three Bears.
Yeah, so the first bike he gets has I think he was running Shimano pedals. The first bike he got was Look pedals. He gets on it and then he like can't clip in. And he looks down and he's like, "What the hell is this?" And he gives it back to the mechanic. The mechanic gets another bike. That bike has Speed Plays.
Have they asked him what pedals he had or not?
You could just see, like, look at them.
It was obvious.
Yeah. So, second bike comes off, Speed Play pedals, which look nothing like Shimano pedals. And Niels Paulet just looks at the bike and is like, "That isn't going to work," and sends it away again. And then a third bike comes off the roof, and it is finally the correct pedals, but it is a small size bike, and Niels Paulet is a large size man. And he gets on it, and his knees basically hit him in the chest, and he gets immediately off again and just, like, gives it back. He's like, "You know what? I'm just gonna wait for my team car.
Look of absolute disgust on his face.
What was it?
With his blue bike that he doesn't want, that is the wrong size.
Why do they make those bikes look so amateur? Like, I reckon if they weren't that shade of blue, if they just made them like black.
I mean,
it would be fine.
It used to be Mavic, and they used to be yellow.
At least the yellow ones were kind of. At least that's brand, like on brand.
Yeah, I mean.
The blue. It's like someone's like quickly knit around to Decathlon and just put a bunch on the roof.
It's like Goldilocks and the Three Bears.
It's just the Shimano blue.
This bike has Speed Play pedals. This bike has.
Oh, we're doing it all.
Look,
we're
pedals.
Doing the whole thing.
This bike is Shimano, but it's too small.
I'm gonna have nightmares about that.
There's a comical bit though. It's like when you see his chain break and it just kind of dangles behind.
It's
like
so
I've never seen that happen before. What did he do?
I mean, chains don't break that often anymore, but they do break. Like, sometimes they just break.
It's like when my dog, like, bolts off and, like, is dragging the leash behind him, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, when you do the power output of Niels Paulet, you probably break more chains than other people do, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was tragic because he finally got his opportunity in the breakaway. He looked like he was riding really well. The break he was in actually did end up coming back. Like, it looked like it was gone. But it ended up coming back, maybe because he wasn't in it anymore. I don't know. He was probably driving the thing.
Shimano conspiracy.
If I remember correctly, they never got to 2 minutes.
No. Well, that whole move came back, and then another one went off, and it was kind of like partially the same riders, and
right.
It was all very
when
convoluted.
Uno X and IPT started pulling.
Yep.
Which is not something I expected to see on stage 19 of the Tour de France.
And EF, because they missed it as well.
Outside of today's stage, but involving riders who are in the race... Jerome Van Aert was born.
Yeah.
A perfectly timed baby.
Jerome Rolex Van Aert.
Yep. That has been a lot of people's reaction, is that the posting of the baby on social media announced Jerome Van Aert.
Half of the photo is Wout's watch.
Half of the photo is Wout Van Aert's watch. I don't know specifically what one. Maybe we can talk to UAE Team Emirates official horologist about this. We'll have to see.
Well, we are in Besançon. Which a scene you have not set.
Which oh, yeah.
The,
I have not, yeah.
The classic, the
we also didn't introduce anybody,
home
did we?
Of watchmaking in
oh, is
Eastern
it?
France, yeah.
Oh, nice.
Because we're right at the Swiss border.
Oh, that makes sense, yeah. Yeah, sorry. It's the same gang. It's Kaylee Fretz.
Yep.
Me, Johnny Long.
We don't really have a host tonight because I can't talk.
No, that's it. Set
I'm
it all
Kate
off
right. Wagner. Hello.
It's like a breakaway stage where everything's a bit messy and no one knows what's going to happen. And Joshua Robinson of the Wall Street Journal, of course.
Still here.
Still here, back in action. We're in Besançon. We're outside a bar. I tried to ask for some chairs from another table.
You're specifically told by some French teenagers that you could not have them.
But what I do is I just ask a question, and whatever they say, I try and judge the body language and just take the chairs, but I judged it wrong. Then we obviously get into a conversation, whatever. They find out we're English. They start saying English words. But then if you've ever seen on YouTube, there's this guy from New York who like is very good at learning languages quickly. And he'll just go into he'll go into like Chinese shops or like go to African restaurants. And he will pretend to speak English. And then he'll suddenly switch into their language and surprise them. And that's kind of what Joshua Robinson of the Wall Street Journal did. Because they thought we were all English, and then he suddenly whips out his bilingual French. It was great.
It scared
him. Was it a singular thrill for you to do that? Have you done that? Pulled that move before? It looked quite fun.
It's a well-worn move, I have to say.
Are you weary with it now?
No. It's a good one to have in your back pocket.
Yeah.
You don't want to do it too often.
No.
Because then people catch on.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm new to learning a language that, like, in a way that's, like, serious.
Which one?
Oh, yeah, I wonder. And, like, the thrill is very new for me and extremely pleasurable, so...
It is great when we walk past, like, a group of Slovenian journalists, whereas before you just, like, walk past and you just peel off and go and chat to them. It is impressive. I still am... That's not worn off yet, just to see you go and chatting about whatever.
Yeah, half of it is, like, oh, yesterday, oh, I need a beer, oh, like... Same thing we talk about in English over here.
Yeah, I'm not missing anything. What were you going to say, Kaylee?
Nothing.
Oh,
I'm not saying anything tonight.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. The scene is pretty set, though.
The scene is finally set now.
All the buildings are made of big, slightly blue stone.
It's a nice place. We're all currently looking at one restaurant, which we didn't go to for dinner. We went to a lovely restaurant. There's a restaurant called Burgers de Papa, which doesn't look like...
Yeah.
I don't want any of Papa's burgers.
Nope.
Another point of interest on a run sheet. Before we start recording, I admitted something that I was worried about admitting, that we've seen a lot of people holding up signs for Julian Alaphilippe that says, Ale Alain Philippe. And I didn't know what it was, and I felt like I should know about it, so I just didn't ask anyone for a long time and kept to myself hoping I'd find out. I haven't. But, Josh, you have the answer.
Yeah, it's kind of a self-effacing joke from French fans of how... They sort of laugh at how the Tour de France brings in all the casuals.
Mm.
And the casuals don't know that Alaphilippe is actually just his last name.
Okay.
And so they think sometimes his name might be Alain Philippe.
I like that.
I like it a lot.
It's sort of from the same department of rooting for Thibaut Pinot and needing to say his full name every time.
Thibaut Pinot, yeah.
Thibaut Pinot, and spelling it T-I-B-O-P-I-N-O.
Is it?
I've seen a lot of those signs, actually.
Is Alain Philippe the Tour de France equivalent of It's Coming Home?
A little bit.
Okay.
Yeah. There's some of that. There's some of the general allez, allez, allez.
Okay.
Which you hear a lot. But yeah, that's quite a good analogy, actually.
Okay. I'm glad it's taken 19 days and figured that out.
Is it time for corners?
I think it might be. Have we got a Slovenian corner this evening?
Yes, since Matej Mohorič won today.
Where's he from?
He is from the Gorenska region in a little town called Poblica.
Is it nice there?
It's a very small town. It's just like... A little village.
What about the general?
It's quite hilly. Gorenska is beautiful. This is like the part of Slovenia where all of the skiing happens.
Oh, fun.
And, you know, there is actually a Slovenian version of the song, Country Roads Take Me Home, which goes, it's called Sivopot. We have to learn it in Slovenian class.
Sivopot.
Anyways, but like it's about Gorenska, and it goes, Na Gorenska. And it's just like, yeah. So bring that up. But in Slovenian Corner today, we have Matej Mohorič, and I thought I would tell one of my favorite Mohorič stories. So a lot of people probably know this already, but Mohorič first signed with Liquid Gas, I think in 2014 or around that time. And then, of course, they got bought out they were Cannondale. After. And so he went from being on a heavily Italian team to suddenly being shoved into with a bunch of Americans. And they sent him to the United States, which he did not like. So Mohorič had some issues with altitude sickness. And
he go to Colorado?
Yes. They made him go to tour of Colorado, tour of California, tour of Utah. He was living in California at the time. And he expressed to me over apple strudel at his house when I was profiling him for Roulaire. He said the things that freaked him out the most about America were that, like, first of all, he was miserable. He said, like, A, the food made me instantly fat, and there was nothing I could eat or change that would not make that happen. And two, he said he was really freaked out that how he would go to the supermarket and all of the fruits... all of the apples. He kept talking about the apples. Like, why do all the apples, like, why do they look the same? Why are they the same size? Like, why are they, like, identical clones of each other? That's not how an apple is. That's not, they look like they're, like...
Is this true?
Fake food.
Our fruit...
You have quite shiny apples from what I remember.
Our fruits and veggies
the shininess.
I couldn't tell you why they're all the same size, other than probably
they select them, don't they?
Yeah, they just selected for the same size. They probably get filtered in some way. But yeah, they're all.
But he was mad freaked out by America's apples, and that
they're very homogenous.
And he said to me, "No offense, but like, why is food in your country so bad?"
Good questions.
And you know, he was kind of spitting with that one.
I mean, he's right.
Yeah.
Someone get him an Oddbox subscription. Oh.
They're singing Happy Birthday. There they go.
Now all of you know that in France they use the same tune.
Yeah. It's like just like Country Roads. He's got a present.
We're getting some Napoleon banter now about the Battle of Waterloo.
Are we? Yeah. Historical banter.
Well, Besançon was an old town, so they might be more connected to history.
It must be his 143rd birthday.
Did you know that Napoleon once managed Slovenia?
No. You're kidding.
No, I'm serious. Like, just for a short amount of time. And actually, he was so loved in Slovenia because he reformed the education system there. Which was at the time heavily Germanic, and like let them speak Slovenian in schools. And that they built, they have like a corner in Ljubljana where like they built a monument to him. That's like the square of the French Revolution or whatever. And nice. So like, yeah, they were big Napoleon fans there. But yeah, he managed them for like a short amount of time.
That was like its own little accidental Slovenian quarter right there.
Yeah, so we've had like,
Napoleon corner.
Yeah.
Cool. More corners. Time for the Maya Sabra.
Yeah,
why not? Why not? Why not? Kaylee's holding on just about. Gonna get you to Paris. Fabio Jakobsen style.
This
gonna
is
push you up that climb.
This is Ian's fault, by the way.
Kaylee's is it? Diagnosed.
Oh, for sure.
Kaylee's gonna have to room alone, have breakfast alone at the hotel.
I blame Ian.
You can't have a DNS now.
No, I'm not gonna. I want DNS. We're so close.
I'm not gonna draw this out. Mikael Landa's still the Maya Sabra.
That's actually kind of surprising.
Yeah. I'm going to double check I've got this correct. I'm pretty sure I have. Yes, he is. That sucks. Mikael Landa, would you mind? Because it's not even like he's close. It's an hour, 3 minutes, and a second.
We have our new corner from last night.
Okay, good. Yeah, please take us out of the...
Which we found a name for.
Well, we were given a number of suggestions.
We were given a lot of suggestions.
One of them was that the early leader was the piss off.
Yep. And then from a one of the meme lords on Instagram, I think Midweek Cycling, I think is what this meme lord is.
What is the corner? For those of us who don't know.
The corner is we go through the jury report. And you have to guess who is in trouble today for peeing in public.
Oh, then I've got one for you.
Yeah?
Because in France, when you say le petit coin, the little corner, that is slang for going to the bathroom. You go to the little corner.
No.
And the probably apocryphal origin of that is like in palaces like Versailles, which did not have indoor plumbing, people would just
go in the corner.
Use the corner to relieve themselves. But the little corner, le petit coin,
is
slang for the bathroom.
There's a club in Leicester called Mosh. I've never been, but I've been told. And they have separate corners where you vomit in one of them, you urinate in the other, and then other things happen in the other corners, which I won't go into.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
I will never go there.
No.
The name suggestion from our meme lord is You're in Trouble.
I like that one.
So after all of that, we don't.
Oh, we don't.
Nobody is in trouble for urinating in public today.
We're really limping to the end of this race. No Maya Sabra changes. No, you're in trouble.
However, we can just switch it up.
Okay.
And we can do it instead for who got in trouble today for chucking their bidon, their water bottle. In the wrong place.
In the opposite place to where you can pee.
Apparently.
Because you chuck your bottle where there are fans and you pee where there aren't fans.
Yep. This individual was handed a 200 Swiss franc fine for breaking Article 2.12.007.
I'm going to guess it was Tom Pidcock.
This individual is on the team of the rider who will probably win the Tour de France.
Oh.
Interesting. I am going to say that it's Christophe Laporte.
I reckon, okay, my guess is Thierry Benoot.
It's Christophe Laporte.
Oh,
yes!
Damn it.
Rare Kate win.
Does that, I don't think that changes his order in the best Christophe.
No, I mean, he didn't win anyway.
No, but I mean, didn't that bump him up to third or?
No, I don't think so.
No.
Yeah.
They
also checked 8 bikes for motors.
Did they? Did they find any?
They did not.
That's weird.
Damn. Foiled again.
What do you think goes through that guy's head every day? Do you think he's still meticulous? I've seen him check them, but it's sort of like a... And he does check them properly, but in the way he does it, it's sort of like, this is a giant waste of my time.
He's not expecting to find any.
Do you think the iPad would literally drop out of his hand for if it happens?
Yep.
Does the thing buzz if it goes off?
Would he be more or less surprised to find a motor than the Shimano Neutral Service people are to be asked for a bike?
Terrified. Absolutely terrified.
What if he just like, he's like, he hears something rattling around in there, and then he just like, it's like, we need to open it up, and it's just like Jonas Vingegaard's AirTag.
We should start following him around, like playing like motor noises out of our phone so he like starts checking him.
Dude, that's a great prank.
Do you think that finding or not finding a motor is better for his employment? Continued employment as the motor checker guy? Like, is it better if he doesn't find one or if he finds one? But then maybe they bring in a whole team.
Yeah. I mean, at some point, maybe they'll stop checking.
Oh, I didn't. Can he stop, though?
No. You got to keep checking.
Maybe as long as Le Partien is UCI president. I would like to briefly say before we end this podcast, I spent the whole day with Zach Williams and Chris Auld. Best friend, Zach Williams. Good friend Chris Old. They both listen to the podcast regularly, so we were in the car doing the "Wow, to a fucking motorbike" impression quite a lot. That was getting us on our way. Just chatting about stuff. Learned a lot about.
What did you learn from your day with the photographers? How is it different from our day?
It's way more fun, is what I will say. It's, you see the bike race, like you meet a bunch of like French people. You don't really stop for lunch, which is a problem. Which means that when you get to the press room, you kind of want the press buffet, but then all the journalists have eaten it.
Yeah, we did
that.
And
apparently that's a big point of contention between that we weren't aware of between the photographers and the press. I suggested maybe we start like making up plates for them and keeping them behind.
We could do that.
We could do something like that. What else? It's all written down on my phone, on my notes. What else did I learn?
Are you any good at taking pictures?
No, terrible. Oh, what we did find out is it's very stressful, and you spend the whole time fighting like the race, and there's a van that goes and takes off all the signs for the directions. And what happens is you can get in front of that van, like just like when you take off after taking the picture, because it's quite slow, the van. And the gendarme waves you down, lets the van overtake you to take down signs, but then doesn't let you overtake for every sign. So you just get stuck behind this very slow van until you can find like a cut point. So it's infuriating, and lots of rude words are said constantly at this man in his van. But most of the job is like navigating the route and like finding cuts, they call it. It's like they have loads of terminology for it. And then you find all these cuts, you finally get to the place, and then your photograph can be ruined because maybe like the moto is like just right behind the riders, and then you just can't see anything from your lovely, like how you've set up your shot and everything like that. So it seems like an impossibly and interminably frustrating job to do, but I guess a rewarding when you do get a good shot.
One thing that I do know some tour photographers do is actually preview the route on Google Maps.
Yeah, the Grubers do that apparently.
Interesting.
But what ends up happening as well is that you can preview as much as you want. It does help, because you might find the odd place where you wouldn't otherwise. But so the whole day we were just driving the course, and then you'd find somewhere to stop, and you kind of make a guess of like, this is probably as good as it's going to get or close. You stop, you wait for a few minutes, and then like from other converging roads, basically loads of other photographers pop up, because there's only so many like nice towns on the route, and you're not just going to shoot like some like grassy verge. So they often all end up in the same spot, and then they're like trying to find the different angles and stuff. But it's quite a collegial atmosphere. Like, they all help each other out. Like, if you miss a finish, someone else might lend you photos that day, or, you know, if your laptop breaks, then someone lends you your laptop. It seems quite fun. They this year and for a couple of years, they all, at least the group that we were hanging out with, and their large group, they all camp the Tour de France. So they have a couple of vans and a bunch of tents and their bikes. They ride in the morning, cook dinner, hang out, go shoot the bike race, find another campsite. Seems like a pretty fun way to spend the tour.
Because they all have like a bunch of clients, and that's the sharing images thing is interesting to me. So like if they miss a finish, but their client needs the post up shot, they just share them.
Yeah, pretty much. Like
that's cool.
They told me that, and it was fine to share. Because they do it for each other, you know, and like sometimes a finish line shot is a finish line shot, you know, and you've got agreements with people. But it's very stressful because you're constantly trying to fulfill the sort of creative desire to take a nice photo, but also fulfilling your client needs where they want very specific things sometimes, whereas you'd rather go and take nice photos of the bike race. Fascinating industry. I hadn't really given as much thought to as I probably should. And they think about the bike race in completely different ways. So like the Col de la Lowe's, they went to the finish just in case Jonas Vingegaard would have won, because then that would have been like the defining shot of the tour of him like emerging on that climb. But obviously like Felix Gall, great win, but like no one's necessarily going to remember that apart from maybe Felix Gall and his immediate family.
Yep.
Whereas the shot would have been on the Col de la Lowe's and Vingegaard like climbing that mountain. So constantly they are basically battling not being too disappointed with how things are going. It made me feel like our jobs are a lot easier because we can kind of, if we like mess it up or miss something, we can kind of fudge it. But if you mess up your photo, you mess up your photo.
Yeah. I mean, if we miss an interview, somebody in our written press WhatsApp group will send the audio out.
I'll be writing a piece on that. It was great. Good fun.
Well, before we wrap up today, we do have to get over to Jose Bain tomorrow.
Yep.
The second to last stage of the Tour de France.
Nice. Appreciate that.
Col du Platzerwassel.
Sounds delicious.
Col de la Schlucht. Schlucht. Who knows? Lamarckstein. Our mountain and place names all sound very German, and that is right because the eastern part of France was part of Germany for extended periods in history. We're going to hear all about it.
One more mountain stage to go. And you might remember the climb, the Col de Platzerwassel, from last year Tour de France Femmes. Le Markstein is the same Finnish town as stage 7 last year. On the Col du Platzerwassel, 60 kilometers from the finish line, Annemiek van Vleuten launched her attack and eventually put over 3 minutes into the competition. The run-up to Le Markstein for the men's final is different, with the Col du Platzerwassel coming right at the end. These names have a distinct German sound to it, as does the Col de la Schlucht, that comes at 54 kilometers from the line. This is because this part of France wasn't always French. For extended periods of time, it was part of the Holy Roman Empire, which was more than just present-day Germany. At its height in the 12th and 13th centuries, the empire consisted of big parts of present-day Germany, but also Austria, Switzerland, the Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, the Czech Republic, and even parts of Italy and Poland. And yes, some parts of France, albeit very small. For the Alsace, the region we are racing in, the most recent periods of German occupation were between 1870 and 1918, and between 1940 and 1945. In 1870, France suffered a major defeat in a war with Germany, then called Prussia. As a result, Alsace and northeastern Lorraine were annexed to Germany at the Treaty of Frankfurt in 1871. This is the so-called Reichsland Elsass-Lothringen, and that was governed from Berlin. Many inhabitants didn't really agree with this being part of the German Empire, but the successful recovery of the economy post-war and the social legislation of the German Chancellor Bismarck improved the German image considerably over the years. However, in the years before the First World War, tensions between France and Germany rose again, and the mood in the Alsace became anti-German. In August of 1914, at the start of World War I, the German attack on France began. The French occupied all the passes in the Vosges, while the Germans took the Alsace. The the front lay straight through the Vosges. A very bloody battle was fought for 4 years, which lasted until the armistice on November the 11th, 1918. At the Peace of Versailles, it was decided that the Alsace, with Lorraine, became French territory again. But in 1940, the Alsace was again occupied by the Germans, and Alsatians were even forced to serve in the German army. Moreover, the Germans had the plan to Germanize the Alsace indefinitely. In January of 1945, the Germans were driven back to the Rhine, and on February 2nd, 1945, the French and Americans entered Colmar. Alsace became part of France again and has been ever since. Nowadays, the once active movement to become an independent country is quite quiet. The local language, Alemannisch, is hardly spoken anymore, and prominent buildings of the European Union are actually in Strasbourg. But the place names, or many of them, still testify of a once German past.
I did not know that.
Is that not where Arsene Wenger's from as well?
Noted Tour de France guest, Arsene Wenger.
Noted Tour de France guest, yes.
Yeah.
That's all I got about Alsace Lorraine.
He grew up speaking a German dialect before he spoke French.
Really? Wow.
Is it time to wrap up?
Yeah, we'll save your voice. Hopefully you come roaring back tomorrow.
I'm hopeful, but not necessarily optimistic.
If your voice completely goes and you can't appear on the podcast, can we issue like a Tour de France team-esque statement of like, sadly, Kaylee Fretz?
I think you should just get Grecian Nierman to come on and talk about motorbikes instead.
That sounds great.
He's kind of a bit scary in person, but I would love to like get him on mic doing, "Wow, your fucking motorbike," just to like close out the podcast every day or something.
We should ask him. All right. Let's wrap it up. We will be back tomorrow.
For the second to last day of the tour.
For the second to last day of the tour from, well, somewhere near La Marchstein.
At least it's going to be a good stage, and it's not a time trial. That always feels like a bit of a bum out way to end.
It's a big day tomorrow. I mean, like, if what happened earlier in the week had not happened, it was still close, tomorrow would be a big, big, big deal.
Big, 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 big.
As it is. You know, like, I think if Pogacar feels better, I think he'll go for a stage win. And Vingegaard might just let him. I don't know.
The power move would be to let Pogacar take back like 4 minutes and win the stage.
Danger.
Be the best mind game ahead of next year.
All right. Well, we're going to find out.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen, but...
Well, you know what? A week ago, in our fantasy game, I predicted Matej Mohoric to final bit of...
Oh, I'm really sorry.
I predicted a week ago that Mohoric would win the stage, and then this morning we're there in some horrible retail park outside Bourg-en-Bresse, eating our daily pain. Mention the pick I've got. Kate interjects, Mohoric. He was saying he was a bit cooked the other day, and I was like, oh really? He was like, oh well, maybe. You know, sometimes he may have just been like sandbagging, and I was like, well, that's enough information to pick one of the other 100 or so guys, just in case. Got it spot on. Would have closed to within Kaylee, who's first in our league.
Yep.
To an 8 points.
Would have been close.
Eight
but instead,
points and two stages to go.
I picked Laporte, got a couple points out of the day, and I think I'm pretty much out of reach.
I'm fuming.
I am the Jonas Vingegaard of our escape.
I just want to say I'm really sorry. I do feel actually really bad about it. But like in my defense, he did say to me like yesterday, I'm kind of cooked.
Damn it.
I think they're all cooked.
Yeah, maybe.
Every one of them is cooked.
Asper Kaskreen's not cooked.
Johnny's cooked. Johnny's cooked.
Yeah.
Sorry, right. Johnny. I owe Johnny a beer.
We are out of here. We're done. We'll see you tomorrow. Two more episodes. I should mention Abby just today got to Clermont-Ferrand.
She's now enjoying the delights of Clermont-Ferrand.
Got to Clermont-F. We sent her some suggestions of where to grab some dinner because the Tour de France Femme begins on Sunday.
She's going to be down there. Matt Deneef is flying in. He was like in Oman or something.
Yeah, he was flying into Muscat, and then there's like an 8-hour period where we expected to hear from him, but we didn't. So we hope that he's
He just sent a text to our group saying, like, Kate, when are you meeting up with us?
Oh, okay. So he's
Somewhere
fine.
With internet.
Okay.
And good. Then Kate is headed down on Monday morning to catch up with those two, and they're going to cover
the
race.
Yeah, you get more Kate time. I'm sorry.
It's going to be great.
Do you think Slovenia Corner is going to make it to the Tour de France Vanderbilt Zwift podcast?
No.
Okay.
We will have daily podcasts throughout the entirety of the Tour de France Femme, plus all the amazing coverage you can possibly imagine on escapecollective.com. So head over to there. Sign up. Make sure you get it all.
$1.
$1.
Joy anniversary.
They're singing happy birthday again. They're not good at it.
Goodbye.
Bye, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.